The Addams Family, Wonder Woman, The Green Hornet, Bonanza, Murder, She Wrote, The Mod Squad, Honey West, Ironside. Just some of the series which have benefited from the writing and producing genius of Arthur Weingarten. And now the legendary writer is live on the Midweek Drive. Prepare to be amazed.
As we are on a regular monthly basis, Arthur, as you well know. How are you, sir? What's the weather like in San Diego?
I am well. What the latest news in San Diego are the winds that have picked up here from the Santa Anas, which come every year. And yesterday we had 94, 96 degree heat and about 40 to 50 mile an hour winds. Not without incident. Mm-hmm. So it's been very exciting.
Well, clearly, Arthur, your good self and Annette should fly over to the University of Lincoln for the Lights Festival from 11 a.m. through to 10 p.m. Actually, Carenza, we talked about this being a global scenario, and it is a global experience that we've got here. Quick introduction, Arthur, by the way. It's Professor Carenza Lewis, Arthur Weingarten.
Hello, Professor. Hello.
Hi, Arthur. I'm really pleased to speak to you from San Diego because I gave a paper about a site in San Diego just last week, believe it or not, by a bizarre coincidence.
Carenza, it's called the rehearsal time, the research we put into the programme. Coincidence has nothing to do with it. Anyway, carry on.
You're blowing the curve there. If you do fly over for the Lincoln Lights, could you possibly, just grab some records from the San Diego State University records for the excavations at the Casa Aguirre site at Old Town, because that is really interesting, and that's what I've been working on.
Well, you should come over.
Right.
Come back over, and you certainly are more than welcome to visit with us. See?
There we are.
And we're very close to what you're talking about.
We've put the Weingartens in touch in times past with Brazilian writers, amongst other things. So it's like a global sort of friendly village that we have here on the Midweek Drive.
Yes, absolutely. It's just wonderful. And I really mean it. That is a true invitation. So I might
well take you up on it because it looks like, having had a look at the records so far, I definitely need to come and have a real look at them because I can't find any evidence at the moment about slate pencils. And I want to know whether the Indian children who were being educated on the mission school that was set up on the site after the sort of wealthy family abandoned it, whether they were teaching them to write. And I can compare the amount of slate pencils that turn up with what we get in England and see what I think.
I can't find any records. I think we should also speak to Professor
Randy
Reinhardt.
One of the great fictions here in California is that Father Junipero Serra was very benign to the Indians. That was only after he had slaughtered all of them and there were none left.
Well, it's a salutary story, isn't it? That's why the archaeology is interesting, actually, because you can start to, it gives you a different story, a different narrative with different biases. So, if we can try and understand more about the experience of the Native Americans, then we can, correct some of the hagiographies, shall we say.
As I said, Professor Randy Reinhardt from Native Voices at the Autry will be with us in a few weeks' time, so we'll connect you with her perspective as well. It's great stuff. Professor Bonnie, Hannah, any thoughts or questions you'd like to put either to Arthur or to Carenza about life, the universe, or anything else, really?
Well, that's a big question.
It is. Just move a bit closer to the microphone and we'll get ourselves sorted out for that. Exactly.
Oh, don't know,
she's just returned back to the show after a long time in Harwich. It's a part of the country we speak only in hushed tones about in so many ways, but it's a hell Harwich. Anyway, go. I think we'll just hold fire on that. Hannah will come up with a question, honestly, within the next few weeks, etc.
Let's
reverse the fact, because, Arthur, one of the key things, we're currently, I would say, almost festivaled out in Lincoln, because we've got the pop-up festival over the way, we've got the Sonophilia Festival that actually starts the same day as Lincoln Light starts from that point of view. Carenza, from your own perspective as somebody relatively new to Lincoln, there is a dynamism and a kinetic energy that we're seeing here that I think it's not unique, but it is a special time we're living through, isn't it?
Well, as you say, I've only relatively recently moved here, so I don't have the long-term perspective, but everyone I know who has known it for longer says it's really changing. And certainly to me, it feels a really dynamic place. You know, the new buildings are appearing all the time. There are new restaurants opening all the time. You know, there's that feeling of it as something that is a place that's whose time has come. Yeah. And it really is, you know, it's a lovely historic heritage city, but it's also very modern. It's very creative. And it just seems to be something that everybody believes in it. And it feels exciting.
Take that, Lincoln, Nebraska. No, only kidding. We like all Lincolns around the place. It's important. Some of the talks that are happening, Arthur, which I think they could almost be titles for either a Murder, She Wrote scenario or one of the sort of scenarios. 50 Shades of Black Grouse.
That's brilliant. Whoever thought of that is brilliant.
I'm almost tempted to say, Carenza, pales when compared to curries, cannabis and antidepressants, new weapons of cancer mass destruction.
It's even better with the really abbreviated...
You are going through a renaissance, or renaissance, as you would say.
A rebirth.
You really are, because, I mean, my God, to have things like that, that's Kool-Aid acid test.
Precisely. We've already talked about 3D scanning in the 2,000-year-old terracotta army. And my Lincolnshire collection, it just sounds wonderful. I mean, it's great stuff.
Hey, maybe you could scan Trump's brain. You know, like I sent you the copy of Galt's brain. Maybe we could do that, you know, and have it in vitro. We could actually extract it if it exists and send it over.
This is actually spot on, Arthur, because you rightly sort of refer to the classic episode of the Linda Carter-era Wonder Woman, and you were kind enough to send me a script wee while back now, but it's called Galt's brain. And indeed, it is a disembodied brain. In fact, Arthur, we share the tale of Galt's brain, because I think Trump's brain is just about waiting to be written at this moment in time. So go, Arthur.
Well, I actually, you embarrassed me. All I remember is it was dismembered and sitting in a vat of chemicals, and it was going gloppity, gloppity, gloppity. But what the story
just
was
like Trump.
Beyond
exactly.
me.
Is it what a wonderful way to tease ahead to Andrew David's American presidential program than Galt's brain, a disembodied scenario that just goes clumpeter, clumpeter, clumpeter. It's amazing.
Right.
So highlight of 1976.
I will tell you one thing, one breaking news thing, at least for the UK breaking news. This morning, Trump came out on, we have a right-wing channel, Fox News.
Oh,
which,
yeah. Fox right-wing?
Yes, Mr. Murdoch and his crowd. And so he came there to disassemble his loss in the debate. And he said, well, of course, I won hundreds of polls, but the biggest one was the CBS network poll. I won it by a vast majority. Now, CBS is one of the major three networks. And so CBS, of course, was forced to say, we didn't run a poll. But that didn't seem to dissuade him.
Sadly, it seems to be if you just say it and people who want to believe it will believe it anyway, don't you?
Well, of course, exactly. It's, you know, he's the spore from out of space. He puts the idea that if you blast enough of these things, some will stick somewhere, and, you know, it doesn't matter. He just moves on.
Donald Trump is the spore from outer space. It could be the unbelievable truth. Which, curious enough, you're also presenting, Carenza. Talk to us about the unbelievable truth.
Well, that's something we're going to run that next year rather than this year, actually. But the idea of that is giving people the chance to invent false explanations for objects and then see if they can con other people, or persuade other people to believe the false explanation. We've done this lots of times with you know, teams, effectively, and you come up with two false explanations and you read all three, the true one and the two false ones out, and you can present them as much as you want, you know, and then everyone else has to then guess for each object which are the true and false explanations. And each team takes it in turn to present their object and go up with false explanations. So that's great fun. We're actually going to run that next year, rather than this year now.
It'll happen.
Yeah, that's very good. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, not to take any thunder away from you, because any idea is a good idea if it's well done, but there was both a radio show and a television show here in America that was based exactly on that, and it's like To Tell the Truth. You had three people, two gave you a absolutely fictitious thing of a word like whatever you would want, Dionysus, and the one was the correct one, and... and it was like Liar's Poker.
Yeah, to be honest, Arthur, there was a series in the UK called Call My Bluff many years ago, which again was the same game.
That I
was based on
that,
words.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was words rather than objects. But objects are quite fun.
They're great. It's wonderful.
But it also highlights the process if you're trying to understand what something might be or how something works. You know, you've got to come up with ideas. And you've then got to be aware of how critically you assess those ideas. So there's a sort of serious scientific message behind it.
Tessa?
Yes, yeah.
Thoughts from yourself?
Oh, goodness. I've been put on the spot again now. Well, we've talked about a lot of things, but I'm going to ask you, Arthur, have you tried your hands at archaeology before? Because obviously that's been...
In archaeology? Yeah, well, actually, you happened to hit on something. I looked at myself in the mirror, and I thought I'm a subject for that today.
Oh, come now, Arthur, please. Remember, we just become more experientially enhanced or chronologically gifted. We do not talk about the O word. It's very critical. We could talk about Arthur's involvement with Bring Him Back Alive, but he doesn't really want to because it was all about a chap who actually went out and did big game hunting and so on. It's not going to work at all.
Yeah, terrible fellow. Terrible fellow.
Exactly. So we'll just sort of hold our fire on that particular sort of mustard from that point of view. Hannah, have you formulated the questions yet?
I have a question. Well, similar on the archaeology front, earlier we were talking about pottery and things. I was wondering if you ever considered doing that in America. On San Diego.
Actually, yes. No, perfect question. I didn't even prime that. Yeah, no, the sort of technique we used to do the Black Death research, which was excavating these 1 meter squares, putting them anywhere, as a method, it would work. I have had conversations with people both at Stanford and at University of Maryland about the possibility of doing something similar in America, because you can investigate the history of any community. I mean, just recently in Lincolnshire, we looked at a council estate built in the 1960s and reconstructed its development, its history, and I won't go into that too much now because it's another story. But you know, you retrieve the evidence of what people did, and it's also a great way of getting communities together, because it's actually the people who live in the community do the digging. And I'd love to do it in America. I think it'd be really interesting, and we talked about this at a conference I was at recently, you know, to see get community archaeology and that same sort of, actually let's do some digging and get some new data and try and understand how a place developed. And of course, if you're working on East Coast and West Coast, the sort of historical development is very different. So I think it would work brilliantly, and I'd really like to give it a try. Arthur, can you help us with that?
Yeah, I bet we could.
It'll happen.
You know, this area is very rich in, as you well know, in indigenous people. The problem in olden times, the problem, of course, was unbridled development before there were any laws like that. And England even has far greater impact on saving sites before anybody can put up a 90-story skyscraper. But here in San Diego, it was such unbridled growth. For years, this was literally a desert with a few green spots. In the last 30, 40 years, it has become a megalopolis. And so God knows how many sites must have been destroyed in this unbridled building. But we live, and I'm looking at it right now, I'm sitting outside on the patio, in what's called the Box Canyon. It's a very deep canyon, a wildlife preserve, and it has not been touched since literally the days of the indigenous Indian here. So I would invite you to come, and I'll lower you on a Jacob's ladder into the bottom of it, and you can dig away at your heart's content.
Well, do you know, even better than that, actually, most of the digging I do, we get people who are actually living in the area to do the digging, because we don't want to take it away from you, so I'll lower you into the
ground. Oh, my word.
I wanted a visual to send back to Alex.
I think the special relationship is alive and well, and living as demonstrated by Professor Carenza Lewis and Arthur Weingarten. We have restored any kind of challenges that might have been faced with respect to various other things. It's good news all around. Emily, would you like to pop those last two questions to Arthur Weingarten, please?
Yes. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Reasonably doesn't begin to cover it. It's been delightful.
And will we be speaking to you again soon?
I certainly hope so. Absolutely. And that invitation, Professor, is a real one. So, you know, please get all the information from Alex.
Can I give a quick name check to someone in San Diego who's really helped me recently? She's called
Jamie Lennox
At San Diego State University. Really helped me with the archives for the Casa Aguirre and the Presidio site in San Diego. So,
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
It's like two-way family
well,
favourites.
There you are.
21st century. Brilliant stuff. You're bonding across the whole base. Arthur, as ever, we salute you. Time now for another Hannah Brown ident, because, again, we've been working our way through numbers. This is, of course, done by Americans, so bear in mind the slight mispronunciation of Harwich.
Hannah Brown, historic Harwich heroine and hyperbolic midweek drivette.
Are you sure it's not Harwich? Harwich heroine?
What did I say?
You said Harwich. The hyperbolic midweek drivette was right. Also, I love the deep breath you took before Hannah. Hannah Brown. Like you're taking a big bite out of Hannah Brown. We're keeping all this in.
William Coles again, because William, you're back with us, are you not, sir?
Yeah, that's a really good echo you've got there.
Did you see that?
Okay. Have you done your research, William?
I've done my research. I always do my research. I love doing research and homework. I could have been a scientist in another life.
Okay. Take it away. Who do you wish to speak to?
I'd like to speak to the doctor, please.
Professor, please.
Professor. Is it going to be Dame Professor or Professor Dame, by the way?
I think you get the Dame first, actually.
Okay, excellent. About skeletons in the cupboard.
Oh, yes.
Analysing old skeletons. And I have seen two pretty old skeletons, stone ones, in Africa, Littlefoot and Lucy. Can you get anything out of those?
Well, it's more difficult because the less sort of organic material you've got, the more difficult it is to go on. And obviously, from something like Lucy, you can estimate stature. You can look at the way the bones may have malformed or been affected, the pathology of the bones. So if there have been any injuries or any growth retardations that have perpetuated in the bone, then you can get that sort of thing out. And obviously, you've got the different shape of the body. Lucy's a very different hominid, a very earlier species of hominid. But once the sort of fossilisation has occurred, you know, you've had replacement of more of the elements, the atoms and minerals that we'd normally analyse. So, for example, on a skeletal collection that hadn't fossilised, you can look at things like isotopes, and that'll tell you what someone's diet was like, whereabouts they lived, where they were living with when they were a child,
compared to where they were living when they're an adult, because your teeth are a fossil record of your childhood. So that'll record something about where you were living as a child and how your health was. And you can compare that with the adult bone. And different bones replace themselves at different rates. There's a work they did on Richard III recently, as you probably heard about, and they could work out that 2 years before he died, he suddenly started drinking a lot more wine, which was just when he became king. So in answer to your question, yeah, I mean, you can get a fossilisation because it is that replacement of organic material by stone. It's less, you can get less out of it. But that said, you know, it's what you've got from that long ago, and if they weren't fossilised, they wouldn't have survived at all.
If I wanted to turn myself into a fossil when I die, what would be the best way to go about it?
Right. Well, the best thing really is to get yourself deposited somewhere, ideally in water, probably pinned down at the bottom of it, where you've got sediments forming on top. So you want reasonably sort of water where there's a bit of a flow through. So a kind of a river-fed lake or a stream-fed lake, or a kind of a slow curve in a river where you've got lots of sediments being deposited. And so that as the layers build up above you, you're preserved there and nothing comes and moves your bone away. You obviously need to make sure nothing's going to come and eat your body after it's there. You don't want any sort of crocodiles turning up and kind of chewing you up, because that obviously means it won't get fossilised. So, yeah, that's the best way to do it, really. Simply because you want the layers on top of you to protect you as soon as possible. I mean, the other thing is to go for something somewhere very dry, like a mountain cave where it's very, very dry, and the preservation would be very good. But the problem with that is that in terms of fossilisation, which of course takes millions of years to be fossilised, you've got to get incorporated into a layer of rock, and that's why you need to be in something where you've got sediments forming on top of you, so you've got rock layers forming. And then you just sit there and wait for several million years.
So it's going to, even if I'm at the bottom of a river, it's still going to take a long time to turn me into rock.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it'll take a lot. For a long, long time, you will survive as bones within sort of silty mudstone, basically. It takes a long time for that sort of process of sort of mineralisation to occur. I mean, you lose increasingly, you know, as your bones are part collagen, which makes them sort of springy and translucent, and part calcium carbonate, which is what makes them hard and able to support, you know, your body as a skeleton. And you just lose the collagen and it gets replaced by sort of minerals.
Never thought
Has that. Anyone that you've heard of requested that their body be fossilised?
Do you know, I have a vague memory of someone doing that, but I can't remember any of the details. There is, you know, people do sometimes have a, you know, a yearning for that kind of immortality. I mean, mostly people want to be cryogenically frozen these days.
Or at least the head, in the case of Futurama. The head is cryogenically frozen on the grounds that if you can actually sort out the regeneration procedure, you should be able to build a body as well.
Well, yeah, some people, I think the cheap option is to go for just the head. If you want the really expensive option, is to go for the whole body, just in case there's obviously that awful risk that actually they could revive the head and then, you know, kind of not
Oops.
The rest of it.
Exactly.
But the cryogenetics is the idea that you would be revived, whereas fossilisation is not a returnable state.
Or indeed, in the case of cloning, just use the nose, as in Woody Allen's Sleeper. William, it has to be said, I think we've pushed new boundaries in this scenario here. I think possibly the reason we're echoes is maybe headphones are not being worn. That's just a slight routine there. It's a technical sort of studio thing, so we wear our headphones. Corinne's obviously a consummate professional, is wearing headphones, so we'll get those sorted through there. Okay. Does that solve your challenges? Does it solve your challenges? Has Carenza, I mean, this could be a whole new feature, actually, Carenza, in which we actually have Ask the Professor. for that. How do I become a fossil? It could be critical to our awareness. Or, I mean, prior to your good self, you know, we've simply actually had items such as...
You're listening to the Midweek Drive on Siren FM, guaranteed to keep you safe from giant lizards.
Or indeed alligators, or indeed crocodiles, which you don't want to eat you. Oh, we've opened up. Would Brayford Pool serve as a possible fossilisation base?
Yeah, very good, actually, because, again, it's you know, you've got a throughput of water through it. There's not a lot of... You know, there's Yeah, I would have thought all right. I mean, mostly it seems fairly... The dig we had in advance of the new building going up, the Isaac Newton building, was it looked like it's mostly kind of peaty, quite very organic deposits. And that will preserve for a long time. The problem with peat is it's quite an acid environment. So you need to have, if you're going to be fossilised, which is really concentrating on bone, you really need a sort of not a very acid environment. But you can also get fossilised, you know, if you're in a lair and everything's fossilised quickly enough, you can sometimes get traces of things like feathers, organic stuff surviving. So you could theoretically get sort of fossilised with the whole of your outline preserved absolutely perfectly. Rather, I mean, there's Pompeii, that's a very different process. But
A volcano erupting in nearby things. That would be a bit too messy, I think, from that perspective. So, well, these are way for... as I mentioned, William, do you feel as though your life has just been made a little bit more informed now?
Yes, can I ask one more question?
Of course you can.
About texting, and we've got all these evil things that happen when you text, like you drive off the road and you walk into a lamppost. Are there any human experiences that are enhanced by texting?
I'm not a particularly great texter. Certainly driving isn't enhanced by it.
Good point.
But, I mean, yeah, I do have this argument with my parents quite a lot, to be quite honest, who have this, you kids, as they fondly think of me, you know, always on your gadgets all the time, why do you do it? I mean, texting, it is one of those things you can get some information back quickly, can't you? It can enhance your appreciation of the environment around you if you can get someone else's thoughts on it or get some information about it. That's a good question, though. I might need to think about that. And I tell you what, you come along on Friday, you can ask Farouk, who's doing the displays about texting while you walk, and see if there's a positive benefit for, I suppose, if somebody texted back and said, watch out, you know, there's a, you know, something dangerous up ahead.
There was a German experiment earlier in the year, I think, where they decided to run the traffic warning signals actually on the floor, on the ground, so that people actually, when they're looking down at the text thing, would also be alerted to the fact that they can't cross on a red light. I don't know if those Germans... William, I'm going to ask Emily to put those last two questions to you, because sadly we've had to say farewell to Lois Snart because she was poorly. It's okay. It's fresh as flu. But Emily's on good form.
So have you had an interesting telephonic link with us today?
It's been the best yet. I've had all these important questions answered as to how to fossilise my own body, which has been worrying me for some time.
Well, hopefully you can sleep a bit easier now that you know you're going to be fossilised.
Yeah. In the museum now as well.
And we'll be joining us again soon.
Just as soon as you ask me. Thank you so much.
This is Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive.
Always good to hear those dulcet tones, isn't it, Larry Nemechek?
Well, it is. If that's your check on them still existing in this plane of existence, then yes, it is.
Well, it is, Larry, but I must admit that the phone seems a very, very crackly and almost inaudible, it has to be said. So I'm almost tempted to say we might call you back. Try again, Larry. Just tell me what the weather like what the weather is currently like in Los Angeles.
The last 2 days we've had a heat wave. It's been over 100 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I think I've had to make an executive decision here and say that rather than struggle through the process where you've got five midweek drivettes that are desperately trying to work, what is he saying? And I know there's America and England separated by a common language. We won't go there. I think what we'll probably do is ask you to hang out, and we'll come back to you in a few moments, but hopefully just a few seconds from now, all being well. If that's okay with you, Larry. Yeah, that's because currently you're in the Delta Quadrant, and it looks as though we're kind of out of control without any kind of connection with the Star Trek thing whatsoever. And that, frankly, is just unacceptable. And as Carenza would say, one thing that we do stress at Lincoln is we don't settle for the unacceptable.
Absolutely. But Dalek, as we appear to have, might be quite
Dalek, possibly. But you know, in this particular instance, no, it just wouldn't be the same. So cue the theme music. I've often said that if in doubt, play the original Carl Malden theme to the Streets of San Francisco, and we say, Larry Nemechek, welcome back to the programme. How are you, sir?
Apparently I'm much better.
Exactly. And, you know, we have got agreement from Emily Jones, from Tessa Snart, from Natasha Armstrong, from Hannah Brown and Professor Carenza Lewis that, yes, you do sound much better.
Obviously. Well, the Romulans were jamming subspace there or something. I don't know what was happening.
Those fiendish Romulans and their tendency to jam subspace, it does get very, very irritating at times. Larry, we were speaking last week with Professor Carenza Lewis about Lawrence Krauss, of course, and Star Trek has got a long and valued history of really focusing on real science. I mean, Gene Roddenberry, of course, as he frequently said, always had a copy of Isaac Asimov's Guides to Science on his desk. And as Asimov himself said, it was a series which, when it dealt with breaking the laws of science, it did them. It broke those laws in a coherent sense. From your own perspective, is that something which we really do celebrate about Star Trek, the fact that it does as a series, which is obviously now celebrating its 50th anniversary, as we've constantly been alluding to? Is that one of the real strengths of the series and how it works and really generates the inspiration for people to work in the sciences as well?
That's, well, you said it all right there, Alex. Yeah, I mean, from day one, Gene wanted this not to be some kind of, you know, science fantasy or whatever, that he wanted it to reflect real life, because he wanted the respect, showing respect to science and giving people a sense of being really grounded was how he thought would reflect on the characters and situations. Because, you know, they started when science fiction wasn't well regarded, much less on the small screen or any screen, really. And if they were going to have believable people with believable situations and these little mini, you know, morality plays, that everything had to be as much in line as they could, and they really wanted everybody to be grounded. And he started off with Harvey Lynn, who was a science advisor at the Rand Corporation. Star Trek has always had real-life science advisors who weren't just token, you know, they weren't just the people in the credits. They really paid attention. A lot of things as Star Trek evolved, especially in the early days with the Cage and the first two pilots, was done at the behest of the science advisors. Everything from like planets and what something would be to like going from lasers to phasers and just all kinds of. Even when the science got postulated, it was, as you said, it was a springboard. It may be grounded. It may be something futuristic, but it's at least grounded in something today and something that we could go in. And that investment in respect has paid off, because there's been this mutual love affair with NASA and Star Trek. And, yes, so many people have been inspired in so many different fields by the respect that Star Trek shows science and rational thinking and that. So that's just one of the many things that makes Star Trek what it is after 50 years.
Carenza, from your own perspective, I'm tempted to say, do you remember the BBC series Bone Kickers? What's going on? What were they doing? It's kind of like the ultimate extreme. I mean, you know, did you look at that and think, what happened? They have murdered my profession.
Yes. In a word, yes. It was such a shame because they had a good cast. The idea was great. I mean, I think the idea, I do think there's a brilliant sort of soap opera to be set in a university archaeology department, to be honest, because you've got all the sort of different potential narratives. I mean, you've got the, you know, obviously within a university department, you've got people at different ages. You've got a good excuse to throughput characters through because you obviously have people coming and going. You've got lots of young people. But then within an archaeology department, you've got exotic locations, so you can potentially take people off to different places. You've got that sense of discovery. You've got skeletons. You've got bodies. You can have a forensic archaeology team who are actually investigating murder. So you've got fantastic ingredients. And yet Bone Kickers was just
disaster.
It was just dreadful because it lost sight of the fact that the subject matter was potentially just really interesting, and they started getting stupid things about funny flipping Boudicca. Oh God!
Yeah,
it was awful.
You can feel the pain, Larry. You can feel, you know, Carenza Lewis's pain going across. And of course, Jean-Luc Picard has got a love of architecture, as he's manifested in several sort of editions of Star Trek: The Next Generation. It was one of his sort of key things, Carenza.
Was archaeology, you mean?
Archaeology, exactly. It's quite, did I say architect? Archaeology from that point of view. Carenza, Star Trek, did it, your consciousness of the lines of Star Trek, etc., your views and thoughts on the series?
I watched it when I was younger. My other half is quite a fan. But I am not.
You'd be very impressed when you say you're speaking to the Dr. Trek now on the show.
Absolutely, yes. I think the new generation one I really like. I like the old series, I like the new series, and it's not often the way that, you know, when you've enjoyed the old series, that you enjoy the new one. But I think it's been great like that. And it, you know, they are, as you say, there's quite often archaeologically themed stories, because it's about other cultures. I mean, it's about meeting other cultures. I guess it's across time and space, but it has that same idea of, you know, there are lots of different ways the world can be.
Well, as ever, Larry, from the current edition of Star Trek magazine, I think you've been very polite in your response to Jeremy's question via email, who actually wrote in, how can Dr. Noonien Sung be in the TV series Enterprise and also in the Next Generation episode Brothers? Wouldn't that make him over 250 years old? How is this possible? Now, you know, clearly he was concerned, but rather than say, watch the series, silly boy, you responded, it would, Jeremy, if it were Noonien Sung. Give the Enterprise Augments trilogy a rewatch and you'll find that it's actually Arik Sung who bedevils Captain Archer in the 2150s, a role cleverly created to be portrayed by Brent Spiner in the tradition of his roles as Data, Law, Noonien Sung. Arik is stated as being the great-grandfather of Data's creator. The in-joke of the recaptured Arik's final musings is meant to portray a shift in his future focus, and apparently for his offspring too, from genetic engineering to artificial intelligence. How often, Carenza, are we faced with a student who puts forward a question and you might sort of think, what a ridiculous... But you pull back, and wasn't that a perfect example of Larry just sort of responding in a way which says, it's OK, it's all right, watch the series.
Sounds very elegant. Yeah, I mean, people ask a question. I mean, some people ask questions just to be difficult, but the best response really is, I don't give them the satisfaction of responding in an angry way. Just play it with a straight bat, and that's obviously what Larry's done.
Exemplary work, Larry. You know, this is why Celeste Yarnell was so fulsome in her praise of you last week. So it's great stuff when we have Yonam and Martha.
Oh, she's a beautiful person.
Exactly. Well, you'll be pleased to know that in upcoming weeks, Larry, continuing our celebration of Star Trek, we're also going to be joined by Patty Yasutaka on the show. Or is it Yasutake? I'm very confused.
Yasutake.
Thank you. So Yasutake is joining us. Would you like to share with the Midweek Drivettes, who collectively are Emily Jones, Natasha Armstrong, Hannah Brown and Tessa Snart, and of course Professor Carenza Lewis, who this actress portrayed in Star Trek The Next Generation?
Oh, she was Nurse Ogawa, who came to be the recurring head nurse under Dr. Crusher on Next Generation.
Do you remember Nurse Ogawa, Carenza?
I can't remember. I can remember Dr. Crusher.
Yeah.
I struggle to call to mind the other character. I clearly haven't watched it. Dr. Crusher was good. It was nice to see. One of the good things about the new generation was that women got a better sort of.
And as we've demonstrated on the Midweek Drive, you see, you need to have, you know, five women against the single male presenter. I'm just the token male, basically, these days.
We're not even holding a knife to your throat to say that, are we?
Exactly. Because, I mean, if we just move on to women in science, which is the next time, we spoke about this, and you mentioned, obviously, your background in Cambridge. The I still think shocking area where Crick and Watson, the people who developed the DNA, they owed it all to Rosalind.
Yeah, and she doesn't. You know, it's always Crick and Watson. You never hear about Rosalind Franklin. Certainly in Cambridge, there's images of her up. She's one of the, you know, the prime female scientists. But yeah, and the popular myth.
But it's worth noting that obviously we have heard of the wonderful Polish investigator of radiation, Marie Curie, because it's actually in her name that part of this Lincoln Knights has actually been established.
Absolutely, it's funded by the Marie Sklodowska Curie Foundation. Actions Fund to commemorate Marie Sklodowska Curie.
It's thankful that she married Pierre. That's all I can actually say. You know, at least if she hadn't married Pierre, we would have been very confused about the whole sort of sequence. But
well, there is quite a debate about, you know, who did most of the work.
They both sadly perished due to radiation poisoning, which was always traumatic, really, from that point of view. It's just taking it too far. It's like the other radiation sort of people who are working on the whole process. Larry, from your own point of view, again, other aspect of Star Trek, it featured cameos from, amongst others, the wonderful Isaac Newton, much beloved of Lincoln Lights, obviously not the real Isaac Newton, but it was the real Stephen Hawking who took part in a poker session with Data. I'm just thinking, as we actually head towards Star Trek Discovery, maybe Professor Carenza Lewis should actually be up for that role as the intergalactic traveller of time and space in the Enterprise. Float that to you, Larry, as a possibility?
You know, there are always possibilities.
Oh, very diplomatic.
I think the campaign starts here, Carenza, to get you on the next series of Star Trek when it launches. Actually, not in January, because it's actually been delayed. It's going to be released in May. So,
May, yeah. I was going to say, anytime you can quote the late, great Leonard Nimoy and just say, there are always possibilities, then you're doing fine.
Exactly. Exactly so. Emily, thoughts or questions for Larry or whomever?
The new Star Trek that's coming out, so that's in May, and is that just straight Star Trek? You know, like the others we've got, like Deep Space Nine, Enterprise, is it just called Star Trek, or what are we looking at?
Larry, help the lady Discovery.
Yes, it's called Star Trek Discovery. It's the name of the ship and the name of the show also. Yes.
I'm super excited. I kind of grew up on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. That was what I watched when I was little, and I'm excited to watch the new one. Deep Space Nine was so good. I miss it.
It's what you leave behind, Emily. Leave behind. Anyway, I could break into a Vince Fontaine number, but not at 26 minutes past 6 o'clock, you know, for the Sirenus. That would just be too much from that point of view. But it is set actually back in the Star Trek Prime TV series, so it's not Star Trek Kelvin. I believe at present it's going to be set there. And any other snippets you'd like to reveal at this stage, Larry, in terms of the sequel? It's got Rod Roddenberry on board, which is nice from that point of view. Are you equally excited in the States?
I'm just very excited. There are so many. Brian Fuller. I'm excited for him to be given the keys as the showrunner. I think I've said that before, but half of the staff have people with Star Trek experience. Nick Meyer, Joe Manosky, Kirsten Beyer, who writes excellent Voyager novels, one of the rare times it had a novelist be part of the staff, and then the rest of the staff are people that have worked with him on some of his really interesting, quirky shows. So I'm just really excited for what they come up with, and I people were worried about that delay till May, and to me, it's like it just shows a lot of faith that the new network or the streaming service, you know, didn't hold them to a deadline. They said, "Fine, take some time to get it done right," which I'm very thankful for. So I'm still excited. I'm so excited. In fact, it'll be even better, obviously, but they have some time to breathe and getting it launched.
And Star Trek Beyond wasn't as traumatic as people thought it was going to be either. It worked well, even though box office wise, it wasn't a huge success. Carenza. Little plug also for Lincoln Lights from that point of view, which is happening this coming Friday. Actually, we started off, it was just only still hours. We were scooting along for that. A one-day science extravaganza illuminating world-changing research. It's very exciting. I mean, Tessa, will you be taking part or will you be visiting the Lincoln Lights activities?
Yes, well, Emily and I, we've just been discussing. We love the look of, I think it's... how you should get a good night's sleep.
Yeah, I did think it was critical for all students.
Exactly. So I think we're definitely going to visit that.
Well, actually, that's a particularly nice one as well, because there's actually a wine reception after that as well. So, and a chance to, I would say the timing, it's actually in the evening. That's wrong in the brochure, but it's corrected on the, it's correct on the website.
Right,
so
okay.
It's 7 till 10. Oh, so there's the talk. And actually, there's a chance also not just to hear about the science, but also to talk to people working on it. So if you want some advice, some Wonder One advice, there's a chance for that over a glass of wine afterwards as well.
That'd be great.
Will you be going, Hannah?
Yes, I am considering it. I only have one seminar on a Friday, so
there we are.
I'm
did
clearly
come
along
exactly.
And have a look.
Come and have a nose round. There's bound to be something, and you can chase around. And it'd be great for you guys to talk about it as well.
Definitely.
So it's, see what's going on.
Spreading the wondrous world, and you can report back next week when we're moving into all sorts of other areas. Hannah, would you like to put those last two questions to Larry Nemechek, please?
I shall. Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this evening?
Once we got it established, indubitably, yes, as always.
That's good. And will you be joining us again soon?
I look forward to it.
Yay!
Efficient, logical,
effective,
and practical. Using
all resources
to the best
of our ability.
Changing,
designing,
adapting
our mentalities.
Improving
our ability
for a better way of life.
And there we have it. A lushy ditty, first time exposed to the listenership there, courtesy of Penny Evans, another delightful Penny tune, which is actually going to be part of a stage production she's involved with, carry-on themes and various other factors. I suspect that Phil Leonis has... Are you there, Phil Leonis?
And thanks for calling.
Oh, dear. It's a voicemail.
At the tone, yeah, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To leave a callback number, press 5.
It's interesting how even in the States they still have that irritating scenario of saying that's 1, 2, 3, etc. Phil Linus, we are very saddened that we're now unable to connect with good self. We've tried home number, we've tried mobile, etc. Doesn't look as though you're going to feel... I know, Tessa, it's all right, don't cry, it'll be okay. First one back. What can we say? You know, and after he worked so hard on Hannah's idents and various other things earlier in the whole piece, and we'd obviously be working on it. But never mind. Phil, we will salute you. We might try again once more before the end of the production, which is coming up fairly rapidly, actually. But for now, farewell. Well, that's what we call leaving a message, which hopefully doesn't cause any offence, but builds that sort of scenario there. It's great stuff there. And Phil Linus may or may not be joining us before the end of the programme. Let's open it up a little bit more. Natasha, any questions for Professor Carenza Lewis about the Grand Festival and various other factors, and what sort of things appeal to yourself?
Well, to start with, I definitely want to go. I think it's amazing. The trouble is knowing what to go to, because there's just so much fabulous things on. I've just moved the microphone slightly closer, then you might be able to hear what I'm saying.
Always on the case, Natasha. It's always impressive.
But no, it's interesting. We were just talking in the music about how this is happening all over Europe at the same time. I mean, is it all the member states? Are they all getting a chance to compete in this?
It's open to everyone who's part of the European Research Network. Right across Europe. The universities have to be... It's not just universities. The Natural History Museum, I think, in the UK is taking part. But it's sort of research organisations. The universities have to bid for the funding. Yeah. So, you know, not everyone gets it. It's open right across Europe.
Do you know how many places in the UK are taking part?
I think there's about 6 or 7, something like that.
Oh, wow, that's pretty...
That's slightly off the top of my head. I remember reading through it when we got the original grant sort of details and looking to see who else had gotten them. From memory, it's about that sort of number. So not huge. And it's great that Lincoln is part of that.
That's amazing,
We're an Eastern University in terms of the UK. You know, we're close to Europe in that way. And it's great to feel that we're part of that. That idea of... Across the whole continent, there is new ideas and discovery going on, and the chance to come and have a look around. It'd be great to have a look online at some of the other things that are going on. And I think perhaps as it develops and carries on, the fact that it's always on the same night, that last Friday in September, to catch up and see what's going on elsewhere. And, the thing is, if you find out what people are doing, come along on Friday, have a look, see what's going on, and you might easily come up with something, I never knew that. Or you might think, gosh, that really relates to something I'm interested in, or something I've learned about, and that can spur off something, suddenly make you think, oh, I've got an idea for a research topic for myself, or I'm going to do a PhD now, because actually I've got something that's a really good... I was just talking about that site in San Diego earlier. That was, I just happened to see that display, and I'm interested in the history of childhood and the experience of childhood in the past, so I was just staggered by the fact there were all these doll parts, And it's that sort of sudden thing when you suddenly, because you know something and you can make connections, that you'll see a connection that nobody else has ever thought of. It's surprisingly easy to do if you're just alert to what you're doing.
No, it's amazing.
The powers of observation and empiricism, of course, which is very important.
So what are you going to come to, Natasha?
I'd love to go to the Black Death in the back garden, just because I find that amazing. I love all the Black Death stuff. Well, I don't love the disease, obviously.
I don't know, Natasha. Origins of Modern Britain last year. I had a feeling you went for the dark side in more cases than one.
I've actually been to Eames to have a look around Eames and the village, which is quite harrowing, actually, when you look around it and...
Yes, it's the sort of, it combines both the 14th century Black Death and then the sort of 17th century outbreak of plague there, and that's the one that's all the documentation about the people in the village who decided they were going to shut the village and nobody was going out and nobody was coming in, and they'd kind of not spread it, but obviously were then vulnerable to not being able to get away from it either. Because it's later on, you've got more in the way of people's personal stories, but even the medieval period, you get accounts of people saying, you've got eyewitness accounts, people writing saying, they buried 5 of their children with their bare hands. It's just you just, what really amazes me is, you know, we every now and again we have health scares, don't we, now, and it's like bird flu or SARS or, you know, swine flu or whatever it is, and it's going to be the next epidemic.
Fresh as flu.
You've got to think about
fresh as flu.
It's going around at the moment.
Right, you know, and I mean, on the whole, I don't think fresh as flu tends to be fatal, but you know, you get these epidemics and people, you know, horrified about the idea of really low rates of mortality, really. Even Ebola, you know, which is that sort of bit. You know, if you get modern treatment, these things are very survivable. And yet, in these epidemics in the past, you get huge percentages of the population, but virtually, you know, the population is halved in the 14th century in a period when they've got no, you know, they've got none of our modern technology and ability to do things, that, you know, and you just wonder how civilization survived. You know, how did it not collapse into anarchy? You know, why didn't everyone? And yet it did carry on. It's really interesting. And one of the reasons I find it interesting is if we know what its impact was, we can kind of better understand how people responded to it. Is it just that, you know, they were all very religious and believed that people said it was God's will and they just had to put up with it? Or were they just more used to having less control over their lives? We so, you know, we don't expect to die young, you know. But it's really interesting. I think there's a lot. I think historical psychology is a new field. I think that what are the universals about the way the human mind works, and what are the ones that are specific to your own time and space?
I was going to consider the technological deity syndrome, but we'll save that. I do need to mention Marco Ciorini, who actually composed the music for Marauder. That's the Penny Evans piece that we heard an excerpt from earlier with Lushy Ditty. But it'd be nice to get Phil Leonis's input on that. Most unlike Phil, it has to be said. He's normally actually there and all sorted through, so hopefully all is well with that world, and will continue to be. We'll be back with the Midweek Drive Morning Edition tomorrow morning, of course, between 8 and 10. Tessa, will you be returning then?
I will be.
Now, Natasha, will you be back for tomorrow morning? Because it's 8 o'clock. She's, yeah, it's going to be early on, the jaw-dropping. Do you know what's that? Hannah, will you be returning?
Yes, I will try to. It'll get me up ready to do work.
Way forward. Yeah. Emily, likewise, so maybe not.
Well, yeah. I've got
don't worry
a radio
about it.
Workshop.
It's, well, yeah. Always good, exactly. It's yeah. Radio and so on. Carenza, have you enjoyed your first ever Midweek Drive?
It's been fantastic, yeah, and I've really enjoyed it. I had no idea what was going to happen. I've just been down to Cambridge there to pick up some finds that I'm going to put in the exhibition on Friday. So I've been sort of rushing down there, screeched in here. No idea what's going on. It's been brilliant. It's been really fun. It's been great working with the girls here. It's been great fun, great working with you.
So will you return?
Absolutely, yes.
That's an important thing. We need to work our way through. Thanks to Cameron Tilbury in Nashville, Anna Lewis in Jersey, William Coles in Edinburgh, Arthur Weingarten in San Diego, Larry Nemechek in Los Angeles. And to the team, thanks to Lois Snott, Tessa Snott, Hannah Brown, Natasha Armstrong, Emily Jones and Professor Carenza Lewis. A reminder, of course, Lincoln Lights, an unbelievable experience that's actually opening up in terms of the whole thing. Actually, it's Lincoln Lights Nights, Get Hold of Tech and Science, genuinely sort of routine. We look forward to hearing from the team what's happening there, and the first, hopefully, of many sort of ways of popularising science
and
research,
course,
and so on.
Siren is going to be broadcasting all through Lights as well, so people can pop in and say what they think about it. In fact, you guys have a look round. Come and say what you think. You know, it'd be really interesting to get that bit of sort of live feedback.
Up next, Andrew David will be taking over the reins for the American presidential debate structure strategy. I don't think they're doing Donald Trump's brain in a jar, despite Arthur Weingarten. Very capable suggestion there. Obviously, the views of presenters are not necessarily those that endorse the science or the siren routine. But that's it. We're out of here. Can we all say bye-bye?
Goodbye. But I don't think they really understood when I said that I wanted to feel in Hollywood. I told them I'd be singing on TV. The other kids were calling me a wannabe.